It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Congress has been busy in the last few weeks negotiating spending packages and other major legislation. We'll check in on where those bills stand and the politics behind them. Now, there's a lot of information out there in the world. Using that info to make decisions can be difficult. That can be true if we're trying to find the best deal on a muffler or make an important medical decision, choose between political candidates, or decide on a guilty or innocent verdict in a jury trial. How do we decide which information is reliable evidence? And when there's evidence that points in different directions, how do we figure out which direction is the right one? Our next guest has been thinking about these questions a lot, and he says we can all learn a lot by thinking about evidence and what it is. In turn, that'll help create better decision-making, better public policy-making, and just better living overall. We're listening back to that conversation now, and we want to hear from you. What does the word evidence mean to you? Do you work in a court setting? Does your use of evidence in a legal context end up in your daily life, too? Do you work in another field where gathering some kind of evidence is important? If you had to change your ideas of what good evidence is and where to get it, let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Frederick Schauer is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. He's the author of several books, including Free Speech, A Philosophical Inquiry, and Profiles, Probabilities, and Stereotypes. His latest book is called The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. We talked to him earlier this year. You're a law professor. I assume you've thought a lot about evidence in your life. What led you, though, to this project, looking at sort of the philosophy behind what is evidence and how we use it, not just in a courtroom?
So back some number of decades ago, when I was a practicing lawyer, I was a trial lawyer. So evidence was a big part of my life. And I've been teaching evidence for a good part of the 40 plus years that I've been an academic and a law professor. So in a sense, just like they say, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Because I teach evidence, I see evidence everywhere. But I think in particular, recent events regarding certainly politics and elections, certainly regarding vaccination for COVID, and a whole bunch of other things seem to have made evidence a little bit more front page news than it was before. And it seemed to me that it was time for me to think about evidence more broadly than just in the context of what lawyers use in trials. So that's what led me to the book. A little bit of it is about law, but most of it is not about law. It's about evidence in numerous different domains.
A big point that I took away is I think sometimes we might think of evidence as sort of a 100% thing. Can we prove something completely conclusively or not? Most of life doesn't really work that way. And we have to think about sort of probabilities when we're setting our standards for evidence. How do we start to adopt that mindset?
Right. You're absolutely right. A running theme of the book is that evidence is probabilistic. Nothing is certainly true or certainly false. It's all about probabilities. And it seems to me that the question of how much probability is enough, how high should the probability be, is largely a question of what turns on it. There is a reason why in a criminal case, we require the prosecution to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, overwhelming probability of guilt before somebody goes to jail. On the other hand, in a normal civil case, one person suing another for contract or automobile accident or whatever, we only require that one side prove their case by a preponderance of the evidence, slightly more than the opposite. So the big takeaway is that we can't know what the burden of proof is. We can't know how much probability we should require unless we know what turns on one answer rather than another.
When, and this is a common experience, when we see a claim of evidence that people say should motivate our behavior, say in a social media posting, do you have a quick sort of a heuristic, they might call it, a quick tool to evaluate that kind of thing?
Sure. two things. One, ignore the adjectives. Very often we see people claiming that there's no conclusive evidence for something, no definitive evidence for something, no concrete evidence, no solid evidence. Ignore the adjectives. When somebody's using an adjective like this, they are trying to smuggle in the burden of proof that helps their side of the argument. So ignore the adjectives. And then the question is, why do I want to know? What turns on knowing? What are the consequences of knowing? And being alert to the fact that sometimes evidence that is far short of conclusive, evidence that's not even very good, might be good enough for some purposes. Compared to what is a crucial question.
We are talking about the new book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Author Fred Schauer is with us, law professor at the University of Virginia. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on proof, on evidence, how you use it in your daily lives, how you evaluate claims. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Now, you look at claims related to the 2020 election. That was one of the big, I think, political things you were referring to a few moments ago. And you quote a few responses to claims of widespread fraud. I want to listen to one that you cite in the book. This is Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, disputing President Trump's claims of voter fraud here in an interview with Savannah Guthrie on NBC's Today Show back in November of 2020.
This is the sort of thing you wish wouldn't happen, but is there any evidence that I'm aware of that there is significant large-scale fraud or malfeasance anywhere in Pennsylvania? Absolutely not.
Well, do you think more of your colleagues, you're a Republican, you're in the United States Senate, the president is suggesting with zero evidence that they are trying to steal the election with illegal votes? As you yourself just said, there is no evidence of that. Do you hope that more of your colleagues come forward and call out those kinds of statements?
My colleagues will make their own decisions.
So can you talk about, this is a big claim, widespread voter fraud enough to affect the election, with your approach to how we evaluate and understand evidence? What goes through your mind listening back to that?
So the first thing is that Senator Toomey is to be applauded for at least saying when somebody makes a claim, when somebody offers a conclusion, ask them what the evidence is for it. It's about politics, it's about everything else. Unfortunately, far too often we're interested in the conclusions and not the evidence in support of them. So the first thing is ask for the evidence, demand evidence, and then having done that, then evaluate the evidence in a way that anyone else would evaluate evidence, not just lawyers, doctors in deciding what diseases we have, scientists, anything else. But the basic idea is look for evidence before you're thinking about the conclusions. Far too often, public debate is about the conclusions. One of the reasons I wrote the book is a frustration with a battle of conclusions and no concern with evidence underlying it. So Senator Toomey and others in this context are to be applauded for trying to shift the discussion away from the conclusions and towards what's the support for those conclusions.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
I wonder if your guest has seen the documentary 2000 Mules, where they have the largest amount of data on the recent election. And proved fairly conclusively, if you look at it, that there were individuals that were tracked going to many, many ballot boxes and dropping off a large number of ballots at each one. There's testimony that they were paid to do that per ballot, and that the thousands of them in close races were more than enough to swing the election.
Jim, thanks for the call. Now, this is the Dinesh D'Souza movie that's making the rounds, Fred. there have been a lot of people evaluating the evidence and finding a lot of the claims falling short. Is that something you've had your eye on?
Yes. So it's one of the things that we can learn from the law is that let's look at both sides. So I have not seen this particular documentary, but if this came up in a court of law, we'd want to hear the other side and give the other side just as much of a chance. So we'd also want to know when you if there are thousands compared to what, what's the percentage, what's the proportion. So I don't think anybody would deny that there are fraudulent things that take place in elections. What I'd really want to know is how often is it more in one direction rather than another, and what would the other side say about that? What's the opposing claim? If we listen to just one side and not the other, we're not taking evidence seriously. Indeed, the last chapter of the book is about a psychological phenomenon called motivated reasoning. It's very well documented that people look at evidence and evaluate it in light of what they want the evidence to show. We need to get over that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Fred Schauer from the University of Virginia Law School, looking at his latest book called The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. When you're looking to make a decision, looking to buy something, deciding who to vote for, you name it, where do you go for evidence? Where do you go for information that's going to swing your decision one way or another? How do you evaluate claims that you come across, say, on the internet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with University of Virginia Law School professor Fred Schauer about his book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Fred, before we go to our callers, I want to pick up on motivated reasoning you were talking about, which can work in a number of different ways. But, you know, any sports fan will know that referees are just biased against their team. And we 100% know that close call should have been called in favor of our team. For watching a sports game, that's not such a big deal. But in more important circumstances, how can we check ourselves so we don't fall victim to interpreting evidence with that built-in bias, that motivated reasoning?
I mean, it's hard. The psychologists who've identified the phenomenon of motivated reasoning have also investigated the various different checks on it, the various different correctives. A lot of them just don't work. We see what we want to see. We evaluate evidence in light of what we want the evidence to show. The sports example is perhaps for many of us the most vivid one. Whether the ball was fair or foul, whether the receiver was inbounds or out of bounds, these are straight out factual conclusions. But we all know that the fans want it to be one way, think that it really was one way, and vice versa. So the best corrective is just knowing about the phenomenon, knowing that it exists, trying to recognize that when we look at evidence, we are likely to be influenced by what we want the evidence to show. And that's the time to just count to 10 and say, am I doing this and why?
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Leo is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Leo.
Hey, I am a retired engineer, and I would like to bring up the basic scientific principle that correspondence is not evidence for causality. This is something that happens all the time, in particular in political ads where, oh, something terrible happened during a president's tenure, but that doesn't mean the president caused it. My favorite example is that I believe during the Obama administration, a comet hit Jupiter, but that doesn't mean that Obama caused it.
Leo, thanks a lot. And this, in our daily lives, Fred, if I had a bad cold and I drank some vodka gimlets, I got better in 5 days. Therefore, they worked. Well, of course, I might have gotten better in 5 days anyway. How do we sort out that correlation causality difference?
Again, in the scientific laboratory or in medical experimentation, we try to control for variables by isolating what did or did not cause something. Your caller's example or your examples are good ones. Again, the best we can do is recognize and at least understand what scientists do in order to deal with the phenomenon. That is, they try to say, let's control for a whole bunch of different variables. Let's see which ones actually make a difference. It's why a good medical experiment is, as it is called, placebo-controlled. If we think that some particular drug cured some particular ailments, the only way to find really definitively find out whether there's causation is to give a substantial number of people a placebo, that is something that might look like a medicine but isn't really, and see if people with the same ailment get better anyway. In real life, we can't always do placebo-controlled experiments about real life, but we can learn from the scientists in just evaluating the evidence. Would this consequence have happened if this cause or alleged cause did not exist?
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Fred Schauer about his new book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Okay, you end your book on kind of a disturbing note, Fred. I'm going to quote your last sentence, if you don't mind a spoiler. For those for whom evidence does not matter, no amount of evidence and no amount of the analysis of evidence is going to make a difference. So a lot of us are concerned maybe about how we analyze evidence and use it. You're worried that a lot of people just don't. They don't care.
They don't care. And part of this is about motivated reasoning. Part of it, though, the optimistic, as you say, this is a pessimistic conclusion. The optimistic part of me would say, and maybe because I'm a professional educator and professional academic, maybe we can make some progress through education. I'm thinking back many decades to the history classes I had in middle school and high school. I learned a lot of facts. I learned a lot of history. I never learned one thing about how historians come to the conclusions about those facts. If we were in teaching history or in teaching anything else more concerned about evidence, maybe we would get people to be more alert to the problems of evidence and not just alert to whether they like the conclusion or not. So, yes, maybe this is some motivated reasoning on my own part that I think that education might make a difference. But again, my high school experience was in that sense formative. I never learned about evidence in high school. I didn't even learn very much about evidence in college. You shouldn't have to wait until you get to law school, if you go to law school, to learn about evidence. It's not just about law.
So it sounds like you're hoping we think more, not just about what we know and what we encounter, but how we know what we know?
Exactly.
How can all of us aren't going to rush to law school to do this for the rest of us? Can you leave us with a minute or so of pointers on how to think in that way?
So I think the way to think in that way initially, like Senator Toomey, just to be alert to the fact that a conclusion follows from evidence, and what even if the conclusion is about a fact. Ask what other facts we want to know to determine if that fact is true or false. So I've got a little bit in the book about art authentication. Once again, Did Leonardo paint, or did he not paint the painting called Salvador Mundi? There are facts that we could look at to determine the answer to that question. So look for more facts. Look for the facts that lead up to the fact that we actually are ultimately concerned with. That's not very informative. Maybe it's not very useful, but that's what evidence really is about, is about preliminary facts that lead to final facts. Look for the preliminary facts. Don't rush to the final facts.
We'll leave it there, Fred. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
That's Fred Schauer, distinguished professor of law at the University of Virginia. He studies the philosophy of law, author of a number of books. We listened back to our talk with him from earlier this year about his newest book. It's called The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Coming up after the news, a congressional reporter joins the program with the latest on a variety of bills on Capitol Hill, ranging from climate change spending to computer chip production and veterans health care, all bills at various stages in the process. Some political controversy behind them. We'll find out what is in them, what is leading to their passage, or what could still stand in their way. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. It's been nearly 10 years since a white supremacist gunman entered the Sikh temple of Wisconsin and fatally shot six people. Sadly, the decade since then has seen more attacks on houses of worship, from a church in South Carolina to the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. As Rob Mentzer reports, for some members of the Sikh temple, that makes this an even more difficult anniversary.
Satwan Singh Kalika brought his wife and two sons to Milwaukee from the Punjab region of India in 1982. He'd been a farmer in India. In America, he worked in a factory and later started a full-service gas station. By 2012, the Milwaukee area was his home. He was president of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. That August, his son Pardeep Kalika had a chance to reflect on just how far his dad had come.
August 3rd was my birthday. It was the last time that I would see I didn't know it at that time, but the last time I would see my father alive.
On August 5th, when a gunman entered the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Satwan Kalika was one of the six people killed. A seventh, who was paralyzed in the shooting, would die from his injuries in 2020. A police roadblock stopped Pardeep Kalika and his young family on their way to the temple that day. He waited all day for word about his father.
My father would do anything and everything to make it back to his community, to his family. He was the most determined man I've ever seen. And so by the end of the day, I knew before they ever made notification that he was probably one of the people that died inside.
The gunman exchanged fire with two officers who arrived within minutes of a 911 call from the temple. He then fatally shot himself. This week, the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin will mark the 10th anniversary of the shootings with a 48-hour prayer. They'll hold community education events and, on Friday evening, a candlelight vigil. Sikh temples across the country will hold community service events of their own. It's a somber anniversary, but for some, it's also frustrating. The last decade has seen a rise in mass shootings, including high-profile terror attacks on places of worship, some by white supremacists. Anisha Singh is the executive director of the nonprofit Sikh Coalition.
Oak Creek can be seen as that warning of an increasingly violent and assertive role that white supremacy was set to play in American society over the next decade.
But if so, she says, it was a warning that wasn't heeded. At a Wednesday evening service, priests and Gurdwara members read prayers. In the next room, volunteers prepare a meal. Families sit on the floor to eat, a symbol of humility and equality. Navi Gill was 18 when the shooting happened. In a library room at the temple, he shows a visitor photos of the victims of the 2012 attack.
These are the images of the six people that were lost. Sita Singh and Ranjit Singh were brothers.
Today, Gil is going to medical school. His life and the world have changed a lot. But when he thinks of the shooting...
Sometimes it feels like it was yesterday. Like, some of the memories are so vivid. It feels like, you know, it just happened. And then you realize, no, like, these people have been out of our lives for 10 years. And you miss them.
The man who opened fire in Oak Creek was named Wade Page. He didn't leave a manifesto or a trail of writings online, but he was an active member of hate groups, and investigators say he probably targeted the Sikh temple because its members are visibly different, mostly brown-skinned, some wearing turbans. Today, Kalika's main work is doing therapy for people who've been captured by extremist ideologies. He's worked with former white supremacists, Islamists, and even eco-terrorists.
Why I do this work is because I think as a society, we do not get upstream enough. And I'm trying to prevent the next Wade Page out there from hurting any community.
Still, he says, it's hard not to feel discouraged. With radical ideologies spreading and the easy availability of guns, Kalika says he fears things are going to get worse before they get better. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Congress has seen a flurry of activity lately with Democratic leaders negotiating with Republicans in some cases and members of their own party in others on a variety of bills. Senate Democrats Chuck Schumer and Joe Manchin reached a deal on reviving a reconciliation package that includes key spending to fight climate change, among other things. Schumer says he plans to call another vote on the PACT Act, which aims to provide health care to veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. And there's been bipartisan support in the passage of the CHIPS Act, aimed at boosting semiconductor production to compete with China. We're catching up on all the moving parts on these bills, some of the politics behind them, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these bills in Congress? Do you want to see Democrats pass something, maybe not the full Build Back Better bill that fell by the wayside, but something on climate change, Medicare price negotiations, and more? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elena Treen is a congressional reporter at Axios. She's a co-author of the weekly Axios Sneak Peek newsletter and covers Capitol Hill, the Biden administration, and elections. Elena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this sort of, I think, surprise to a lot of people, including congressional Democrats. It's called, Democrats are calling it the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, the descendant of the Build Back Better plan that didn't end up passing. Can you tell us what is in this? What's the scope of it?
Yeah, so big news on Capitol Hill dropped last week by Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Chuck Schumer, who had been negotiating this really in secret and in private. They didn't bring in, as you mentioned, really any other Senate Democrats to be involved in these talks. And Manchin says that's because he wasn't sure if they would fail or they'd fall apart. But now it's proving to potentially complicate negotiations and, you know, a final potential passage of this bill. The total price tag of this is $739 billion, which is far less than the $3.5 trillion that had been floated most of last year as Democrats were working toward what was then called the Build Back Better package on climate change and a lot of the more ambitious and progressive priorities of the Biden administration. This bill, the much more smaller deal, like I said, $739 billion, a good chunk of that will go toward a 15% corporate minimum tax, which is what some Democrats, particularly Joe Manchin, is calling just closing the loophole, less of a, you know, raising taxes on corporations, but more so closing loopholes that exist already. $288 billion will go toward prescription drug pricing reform, something that many Democrats have been really eager to pass, but have really failed to do so in the past several years. There is also IRS tax enforcement in there. There's $14 billion for the carried interest loophole. Another good chunk of money for energy security and climate change, and about $64 billion for expansion of the Affordable Care Act. And so those are the main components here. And like I said, it's a much slimmer and narrow focus package compared to what Democrats had initially been pushing for, but really the most realistic thing that they can get done, particularly as we come up against the November midterm elections.
Okay, procedure-wise, this is, as you mentioned, it's the R word, reconciliation, this thing that a party can do a couple times a year. It's a little tricky, but it lets them get past the filibuster. So they could do it with their majority, which is 50 plus a vice president. All Democrats presumably need to be on board with this. Doesn't seem likely to get Republican support. What are the big question marks there when it comes to getting all 50 Democrats in the Senate on board with this thing?
Well, there's a few hiccups that I think are being ironed out as we speak. The biggest one is Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who has really been, I mean, if you look at negotiations over the past year and a half or so of the Biden administration, Senator Sinema and Manchin have always been the two that have stood in the way of a potential reconciliation deal. Again, what would need only a simple majority in the Senate. Manchin is on board because he's been the one who's negotiating this, but they've left Sinema out of the process, which has raised some alarm bells, I think. And I think her team has told me and other reporters that really she was blindsided by the announcement of this deal last week. I think we're going to see more come of that in the next several days. Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, said that he wants to have a vote on this by the end of the week. The Senate is supposed to break by the end of this week to go on their August recess, not returning until early September. So they're really racing against the clock to get this done. I suspect that they'll probably extend their session a couple days longer to iron this out. But getting Senator Sinema on board will be huge. Joe Manchin plans to speak with her on the Senate floor this evening. We'll see if that, goes anywhere. But also her team has been saying that she really wants to see the Senate parliamentarian. Again, this is all very in the weeds, I know, but really to get any kind of deal like this through the reconciliation process, which is a budget process in the Senate, you need it to pass what's called the Byrd rule, which is really ensuring that all of these priorities and the provisions in the broader bill are in line with that whole process for a budget reconciliation package. So Sinema is one big obstacle. Another obstacle, I'd say, are some moderate Democrats, particularly those in the tri-state area like New Jersey, who have really been talking about wanting, if they're going to have any sort of bill that deals with taxes, they want it to eliminate the SALT tax, the state and local tax provision. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey has said that he takes issue that this bill doesn't address SALT. But from the conversations that I've been having with some of these moderate Democrats who care deeply about that issue, it doesn't seem like they're going to hold up the package because of that. And so it really does look like they're on track to get this done, but they do still need to get a couple more things ironed out and particular senators on board to make sure that this passes. Like I said, they want it by the end of the week.
We're talking to Axios congressional reporter Elena Treen about bills working their way through Congress right now. We've been talking about this, what's being called the Inflation Reduction Act, a Democratic effort to do some climate change funding, make some changes to tax policy, allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, and more. Other bills out there, this chip production bill that's gone to President Biden for his signature, a holdup on a veterans health bill as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on any or all of those. If you want to see Democrats accomplish this climate change and other stuff legislation this year, this election year. What about this bill aimed at boosting microchip production here in the United States, trying to boost the technology industry, reduce dependence on China? And have you been following the drama over this bill to fund healthcare for veterans exposed to burn pits? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Elena Treen, congressional reporter at Axios, with us today to share the latest on bills in Congress, including climate change efforts, computer chip production, and health care for veterans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on any of this rush in Congress, this last-minute drama before they go to their August recess? The number's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jim is with us in Bayfield County. Jim, hi.
Oh, hello. Thanks for letting me talk for a second. I'm a veteran of Vietnam. And I've been concerned about this burn pit bill because I've been in mental health treatment with the VA. And there's I noticed quite a few guys claiming disability through the burn pit. And I do not think that the science is there. 3.2 million American veterans are going to claim they've been exposed to burn pit thing. And it's I think it's bogus. I know that it's not very popular what I say, but I sincerely think it's true. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. Elena, Jim referring to this bill in Congress. Remind us what this, it's called the PACT Act, I believe, was intended to do.
Yes, that's right. And it faced some controversy last week, but it looks like it will likely pass. The PACT Act stands for the Promise to Address Comprehensive Toxics Act. And essentially, it's a sweeping military toxic exposure legislation. And the call is very right. A lot of people referring to it as a burn pit bill. And it's supposed to benefit millions of American veterans. And, you know, the controversy around this bill, it's funny and it's very typical with how things work here in Washington. It got caught up and kind of hung up over things that didn't have to do with the bill. I think Republicans for a long time have supported this measure. And then late last week, when talks of this reconciliation bill about with Democrats negotiating it being far bigger than Republicans expected it to include climate change and other provisions, they decided that maybe we don't want to vote on this. And they voted against it and held it up because of those negotiations. But in light of that, a lot of people, including John Stewart and other veterans, have really, you know, spanned the airwaves in the days since that, saying that they need to vote for this and this is a very important bill. And it looks like now it's headed for a procedural vote in the Senate tonight, Monday night, and it'll likely get the 60 votes for it to move forward. And if it does do that, it's very much expected that it will pass and be signed into law by President Joe Biden a few days after that. And so it is on track, I think, to pass. And it looks like Republicans have since kind of dropped their refusal to hold this up. Their intentions to hold this up. And so it looks like it's on track, but definitely a bill that I think many veterans, including the caller, are worried about, and rightfully so.
And the objection from Republicans, the stated objection anyway, wasn't to the content of the bill itself, as I understand it, but to how it was paid for, or I guess they argue not paid for. Is that what they were mostly pointing toward?
Yes. I mean, one of the mostly I think that's where the Republican opposition came in. There's also been some concern over how some of the benefits in the bill will be classified in federal budgeting procedures. One of them is about, you know, whether the funding for this bill, which will be spanned out over the next several years, whether that should be mandatory or something that's voted on consecutively each year moving forward. That's something that Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, has really pushed for, and his amendment to do, you know, to limit whether, you know, not have it be a permanent funding measure, but rather something that's voted on year to year. That's something that the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, is expected to attach in an amendment today. And so if that's voted on, Toomey said that he expects a vote for the bill. I think other Republicans are kind of happy with just having the vote itself. But most, by and large, I think it was kind of opposition to other things that Democrats are doing and not necessarily the contents of this bill itself.
Talking to Elena Treen, congressional reporter at Axios, looking at a flurry of activity in Congress running up to the August recess. Elena, I also mentioned this CHIP Act aimed at boosting microchip production in the United States. Some questions about it as it went into the House after getting some bipartisan support in the Senate ended up passing. Again, remind us a bit of what this bill would do and the politics that ultimately sent it to President Biden for a signature.
Yeah, so the CHIPS bill was huge. And it's something that, again, another one of those bills that has had many different names. And this time it's really focusing on the chip manufacturing and still, though, has a lot of ties to China. It's something that initially was called USICA and something that a bipartisan group of senators passed over a year ago now. And there was a lot of controversy over the size and scope of the bill, but really it's kind of continued to maintain a lot of the same provisions that the initial bill had. It's going to be roughly $250 to $280 billion for the manufacturing industry and for technology and science programs. Funding for the National Science Foundation is a huge part of the bill. And it really is to help set up America to better compete with China. It also addresses a lot of the supply chain issues that I think we've seen in the United States over the past year or so, affected by COVID, also in part affected by current inflation as we're seeing. And so a bill that really a lot of people said was necessary, not only to help the manufacturing industry, but also a national security bill to better position the United States against China.
Briefly, the House also passed an assault weapons ban, an effort to bring back some kind of assault weapons ban. This is on Friday. Now, in the Senate, this one would need 60 votes. That seems like a tall order.
Yes, it's almost guaranteed it will fail in the Senate. I just don't think that there's enough Republicans to get that over the 60 vote threshold that is needed to break the filibuster. And this is a conversation that also came up in light of the massacre in Buffalo and then again in Texas with the Uvalde shooting. There was a reason it didn't. I mean, the Senate and the House, you know, Congress, and it was passed into law, a bipartisan gun safety bill. There's a reason that the senators who negotiated this bill did not include a ban on assault rifles or assault weapons in that bill, because it was known that they would not get enough support to pass. And so while the House has a lot of a much bigger, Democratic majority where they were able to pass this, it really was seen as a messaging bill more so and not something that would be passed into law.
A lot going on in Congress this week. What are you watching for next in the, I guess, hours and days to come?
Well, we talked about a lot of it. I think, the PACT Act will be huge. It's something that a lot of people would expect to pass quite easily and had some hiccups, but I do expect it'll pass this week. And it's a very important bill for veterans. And so that is on track. And reconciliation is going to be massive. It's something that I think took up really most of the oxygen on Capitol Hill for almost all of last year, particularly the latter half of last year, until we saw Senator Joe Manchin kind of shoot it down. Now that there's a deal and they're headed toward potentially putting the bill on the floor as early as the end of this week, everything is going to be on that. And they only have a couple days left before they break for recess. And I know that really the momentum on Capitol Hill, particularly on the Democratic side, is going to be fully focused on getting that reconciliation bill passed. And it's interesting, I think, that with this bill, with the CHIPS bill, with the PACT Act passing, and then that bipartisan gun safety bill I just mentioned, these are all things that Democrats are really eager to go home over recess all throughout August and also in September and October before the midterms and campaign on and show that they have been doing things in Washington, D.C. and trying to deliver wins for the party. It's something that really they're desperate for right now, because they're, President Biden is really lagging in the polls in a way that is really disappointing to a lot of Democrats, and they need these wins. And so I think all eyes will be on the few more bills that they can get done now. And I also just want to note, I think, once they come back from their recess in September, really, they don't have a lot of time to get any other major legislation done. So what we see happen in the next few days is really going to be what we can expect Congress to be passing on a large scale before the November midterm elections.
Elena, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Elena Treen is a congressional reporter at Axios. She was with us today to bring us the latest on a variety of bills in Congress, including climate change, veterans health care, and computer chip production. Democrats trying to get a lot of these bills passed, as we heard, as time is running out leading up to the August recess, and then, of course, the midterm elections coming up in November. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, why do pets do the things that they do? Join the conversation on pet behavior with a couple of experts, and you can call in and share your stories and maybe your questions about your pets and their behavior. That's tomorrow morning at 8. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. I had my first sweet corn of the season over the weekend. I always like fresh sweet corn every year, but I was especially excited for it this year, maybe because it came up on a Food Friday a few weeks back. So Saturday, I was going to grill for people, and I had my heart set on grilled corn on the cob. Just one problem, finding the corn. I had seen some at a farmer's market earlier in the week, so I knew it was out there. I didn't buy it then because I would have had to lug it around all day. Anyhow, Saturday morning, I go by a couple farm stands where I know they usually have corn, but neither of them are open that day for some reason. I'll spare you the dramatic tension. I did find some Wisconsin sweet corn at a grocery store for a good price, too. Soaked it for a while, hit the grill, and yes, it was everything I had been hoping for. I even have a few ears left over to make some street corn, maybe tonight. I want to hear from you. Have you had your first fresh sweet corn of the season? Grilled? Boiled? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Throw us some talk of a food Friday on corn, so watch this space. This is Central Time.